I'm Mel Morgenbesser, and this is the third interview with Emeritus Professor of Social Work Al Kadushian, an interview and an oral history about his long career in social work practice and social work education. Al, I wanted to ask you, you've been involved with social work in one way or another for over 60 years. You've named NASW Pioneer in Social Work for your long-term contributions. We talked about the books that you've published and articles you've published that have been at the core of the heart of social work. So I wondered if you would spend some time talking about, over that long career, what you've seen as the principal issues and principal changes in social work over that time.
Yeah. Now, let me go back a bit to point out that people have been doing social work since the beginning of time. Both the Bible and the Quran mentions the question of charity, and they use the same word, tzedakah. If you go to Florence, there's an institution that was established in 1441 for what was called the gittatelli, castaways, children who were cast away. If you go to Paris, there's an institution in 1535 that deals with enfants trouvés, infants found, and so on and so forth. So all along, there have been people who have been doing what is the equivalent of social work, performing the functions of social work, accepting that it was on a hit-and-miss basis, people who volunteered to do this, people who felt that they were interested in it, but there was no professional organization. A professionalization of social work began around the turn of the century when people who were involved in this kind of activity decided that they wanted to codify the practice wisdom that was available and then establish programs of training for people who might be interested in doing this work. And early in the 20th century, schools were established by, just before World War I, we had five schools of social work. We had the beginning of a literature, social diagnosis, the beginning of textbooks, and so on. Now, over the course of time that I've been associated with social work, there's been increased professionalization of the activity. That development in professionalization was the one that I became interested in social work, seeing this as a very worthy endeavor, a service that was very desirable and that the community needed, but nevertheless one that needed to be upgraded in terms of its research and in terms of its education. And over the course of the 60 years, what we had was a development of the infrastructure of the profession. NASW, the national organization, was established. CSWE, the Council on Social Work Education, that had the responsibility for educational programs. We developed many more schools of social work so that by now we have something like 125 master degree program. We have about 60 DSW or PhD programs. We have over 300 bachelor degree programs. So it has been then a proliferation of the educational establishment and the proliferation of support. In addition, we have amassed a very considerable amount of information that the testimonial to that is the first edition of the Social Work Encyclopedia, which was called the 1929 Yearbook, had 600 pages. The last edition of the Encyclopedia of Social Work has more than 3,000 pages, which indicates something of the mass of information that we've developed over the course of time. As part of the infrastructure, we've had licensing in most states, have registration in many states, and so on and so forth. All of this relates to the infrastructure of a profession, the establishment of the structure of the profession. What is really lacking is the substance of the profession, the knowledge base of the profession that moves on to developing the skills that the worker requires to do an effective job. Now, when I talk about professionalization, I'd like for a moment to define what professionalization implies so that you get some sense of what I'm after. A profession consists of individuals with specialized knowledge obtained through intensive education on the basis of which they provide specialized, efficient, and effective service. The essential primary core characteristic of a profession is the possession of a body of complex, theoretical-based abstract knowledge, and based on such knowledge, technical skills are developed which enable the profession to perform a significant specialized service more effectively and more efficiently than anybody else. So if you say that social work is professionalized, you're saying that we do what we do better than anybody else who might perform the same function. Now, for a period of time, the community gave us a pass. They said, yes, we recognize social work as being more effective than anybody else in doing the functions of social work. And then in the 1970s, a question arose, and in many states, in order to get the job, in order to apply for the application for the job, you had to have a professional degree. In Wisconsin, to become a social worker, you had to have an MSW. Yeah. In many other states, that was true. So they recognized the fact that we do the job better than anybody else, and because we have the qualification to do the job. But with the beginnings of affirmative action in the 1970s, people challenged that. They said, why can't we take the exam, even though we don't have an MSW? What gives you to believe that you actually do the job better than anybody else so that it requires the MSW? And the courts decided and the legislature decided that an MSW really wasn't needed to do the job effectively. And so they threw the jobs open to people who had a bachelor's degree in Italian and history and English and comp literature and so on and so forth. And people then applied and were hired to do the job without reference to the fact that they didn't have the MSW. Now, and that was called declassification. Now, the implication, pardon me?
Around the 70s that happened?
That was in the 70s, with affirmative action and joint affirmative. The definition of declassification of positions is an administrative manifestation of doubt that professional training is actually and demonstrably required to perform the task. The reason for the trend toward declassification needs to be understood. It has generally been assumed that professional training at the university level provides considerable superior levels of practice, knowledge, and skill. But with respect to social work practice, this assumption has been challenged, which is what happened. A lot of the jobs that were previously reserved to social work were now open to people who didn't have social work degrees or hired for the job. Now, one would presume that if it was true that you needed to have the knowledge that you acquired in the MSW program to do the job more effectively, the consequences of declassification on the surface would mean that the jobs being done by people who don't have this prior training would result in bad practice. But then, let me quote from Linda Ravitz, who was at that time director of the Department of Health and Social Services in Wisconsin when she was faced with this question. And she said, Linda Ravitz, who was then director of DHSS, expressed her opposition to social work licensing when she stated, since 1977, when the legislature passed the Civil Service Reform Act, state agencies have not been able to screen applications for positions as social worker by using educational requirements. I have no evidence that this has diminished the quality of persons hired as social work by the agencies at that time. They're saying that you can't prove the fact that the requirements that you suggest are necessary to do an effective job are actually requirements that's validated. Now, if I quote from a 1989 publication, National Center for Social Policy and Practice, they say, the significant lack of valid empirical data demonstrating effectively, and they underline lack of valid empirical data demonstrating effectiveness, perpetuates the spread of the misconception that social work professionals and educational qualifications are not necessary for managing and delivering social services. And then the Comptroller General of the United States reported to Congress in 1980 that state officials saw no special value in social work degrees for casework or supervisors. Quote, officials believe that a four-year bachelor's degree with no particular degree specified, coupled with experience and a proper attitude, end quote, professionally educated staff as against less well-prepared staff, prove the greater effect We were challenged, this is the addition to the quote, we were challenged to prove that the greater effectiveness of professionally educated staff as against less well-prepared staff. We were challenged to approve that. This is from the Comptroller General of the United States. One other, I don't want to belabor this point, but I just want to quote another study that is dated 2001 that indicates, something more recent. This was a study that the Hartford Foundation asked for. The Hartford Foundation, as you know, has given a lot of research grants to social workers. And they were interested in, they call it the labor market for social workers. They were interested in determining for hiring practices whether it was necessary to require the social work master's degree. And so they asked an economist who was a specialist in manpower studies to review the literature in social work and so on and so forth and make some determination as to what was required. And he says, it would appear useful to examine the precise contributions of social work education to the delivery of social work services. Is it true that the delivery of social work services differed in terms of quality and cost when delivered by a social work degree person in contrast to a person with a non-degree person is a better performance? He is once again challenging the statement. And Margaret Gibbelman, who has done a very considerable amount of work on the content of the activities of social workers, in a 2004 publication, she says, the need to document the effectiveness of social worker services has never been more important. So now we're faced with the problem of validating the effectiveness of our professional program. And that has great consequences for child welfare. Now, consequences for child welfare have consequences for social work generally, because the most particular service of social work is in child welfare and families. All of social workers are employed in essentially three different fields of practice: medical health, mental health, and child and family welfare. That constitutes about 70%, close to 70% of all of the social workers. But child welfare is different from the two other fields of practice. Medical social work is associated with nursing in performing overlapping functions. Mental health overlaps with psychologists, with psychiatrists, counselors, and so on. But child welfare is particularly social work. The profession's mandate with the social problems which have been designated by the community as our responsibility is clearer and more certain in child welfare than almost any other field of social work practice. It is one of the few major employment areas in which social workers may set to be to substantially lead, manage, guide, and control the system for which it is responsible. Now, The effect of what I've said previously is particularly interested in its effect on child welfare. Currently, although the statistics are somewhat funny, for the most part, of all of the people who are designated child welfare social workers, only about 25% of those people employed in these positions have professional training. 15% of that 25% are BSWs. 10% are MSWs. So here we have a field of practice that essentially a quiescential field of practice of social work that's performed for 75% of those employed by people who don't have professional training. It's very hard to call that performance as professional performance nationwide.
And there are probably many reasons for that, right?
Yes. I mean,
one is just the immense size of child welfare, I would think. One is you'd need a lot of people.
Yes.
If you hired only social workers, you need a lot of people. The other is the question I think you brought about.
You need a lot of people. And that's why the manpower studies are interested in that, because if you have a pool of people that are available to do the job and can be accepted as doing the job, you don't have to hire highly professional people. So not only is the pool that's available to fulfill the job is greater, but the amount that you're likely to pay that pool of people is less. See? That's one of the people interested in this question. Now, let me come to your question. Why is this the case? Yeah. First of all, it's true that the need for child welfare workers has over the course of the last 40 years expanded rapidly. In 1962, if I remember the date correctly, we discovered pediatricians discovered physical child abuse. And the nation became concerned with physical child abuse. Then they became concerned with neglect. Then they concerned with sexual child abuse. Then they concerned with emotional child abuse. So the concerns that would possibly the interest of social work, child welfare, expanded rapidly. So there was a need for that. On the other hand, we were graduating many people in social work, in child welfare, but who weren't being hired for that because they didn't need to hire professional social workers. They can get by, because of what research is available, with hiring people who had lesser degrees. Okay. Now, what is the difficulty in effectively proving to the community, as they once believed, that we could do the job better than anybody else? What is the lag in validating our professional claim? Now, I think the ultimate achievement of our professional claim is very, very important. We deal with a very sizable population. Over the course of time, we deal with maybe 5 million children and families in child abuse and neglect, in adoptions, in foster care.
We meaning the country's need or social?
Yeah, country.
Okay, the larger country need.
Yeah, once again, a shaky statistic.
Right.
We collect from state to state to have different statistics. But nevertheless, it's a very sizable population. And that population of children and families, we deal with the questions that are of most consequence to people. We deal with parents and children, we deal with husband and wives, we deal with those aspects of people's lives that are the most important, the most loving, the most gratifying of all of the relationships that they have. And on the other hand, it leads to the greatest amount of despair, the greatest amount of disappointment, the greatest amount of injury, and so on and so forth. So they're dealing with a sizable population, and we're dealing with a question that affects people, most people, in the most direct and most consequential manner. Now, achieving that professionalization so that these problems are dealt with, not with anybody who has a history degree or an attending degree, but people who have been specially trained to deal with that problem, is a activity that I feel very strongly needs to be supported and is admirable to begin with. It's one that I've given my life to, nevertheless, without regrets, because I see this objective as a very desirable, very important, very significant objective.
Now, when you say this, Al, you've dedicated your life to it, and yet when you present that very sobering data, are you just presenting one part of the question? I would think you would be kind of depressed and defeated.
Yes, I'm not depressed and defeated.
Good.
I'm not depressed and defeated because the objective that we've set for ourselves in achieving true professionalization so we can do the job better than anybody else, which the people that we serve deserve without question. Our problem is greater than the problems as I see it, than most other professions. First of all, we deal with very difficult kinds of problems. The doctor deals with very definite, very clearly defined problems. A fractured hip, you know, a disease that has an antibiotic. It's clearly defined. We deal with problems that are idiosyncratic, with a multiple, with a dispersive, and so on and so forth. We deal with very, very difficult problems. And we deal with problems that all of the other institutions in society have failed with. See, the school has failed, religion has failed with many of these families, the law has failed, all of the institutions that initially are designed to intercede and do something have failed. And then they give this job to us. The other thing is the professionalization that we hope to achieve is based on the very dubious sciences. See, medicine has chemistry, medicine has biology. These are well-defined, clearly sciences that have achieved great strides. The basis for our work is sociology and psychology, and they don't provide us much in the work of, in the way of theory, in the way of substance, in order to be able to us to take the information and achieve those skills that are effective.
See? So translating the theoretical base to the
into skills
and practice
that's
will
right
actually make a difference.
That's right. It's much more difficult here than would be true in medicine, which has as the base for what it does clearly defined effective sciences. The other thing is that the population we deal with is not the kind of population that medicine and dentistry deals with. Medicine and dentistry deals with everybody. Everybody has a possibility of going to a dentist or a doctor. The population they deal with is a more clearly defined population. Most people do not, during the course of their lives, have to see a social worker. And that population is a population that doesn't have much acceptance in the public mind, you know. Matter of fact, that has less than desirable acceptance. And so we don't have the support that we need in order to be able to cut caseloads to the point where we can do a good job. We don't get the resources we need that would support effectiveness and efficiency in doing the job. So for all of these reasons, despite our best efforts, the likelihood of failure to be able to demonstrate effectiveness or efficiency is not very great. Now, to come back to what I said before, that doesn't negate the desirability of trying to achieve this objective.
Does it also mean failure of ability to demonstrate it? Does it mean it necessarily not happening? Or is it a failure of the ability to tease out the fact? In other words, the fact that we haven't been able to show something, does that mean it's not happening? Or does that mean we have a difficulty with the kind of research itself and the
long-term kinds of concepts? No, that's a good question. All along, and I am a party to this effort, all along we've made a sincere effort to achieve the answer to the question that was posed for us. And all along we've been putting together bits and pieces. We're more concerned recently now than we had been in the past with evidence-based practice, which is an indication of the fact that we recognize the question and we're making an endeavor, as we always had from the very beginning. But because of the difficulties I've cited, our success rate in achieving a great measure of what we hope to achieve has eluded us. See? But the Talmud says that it's yours not to have achieved the objective, but it's yours not to abandon the objective. And that's where I stand. I stand, the objective is a very, very desirable one.
And the objective is?
The objective is to develop a professional technology that would enable us to intervene in the situations that we're charged with to intervene by the community, that we were able to go in and score better than we're scoring now, that instead of achieving success in 3 out of 10 cases, we'll achieve success in 5 out of 10 cases. And that objective, I can't emphasize this enough, is an objective that needs to have the support of the community because it is so very desirable. We're dealing with a lot of people who are hurting in very significant ways. See?
And how would that support of the community manifest itself? How would I know that was happening, or what kind of support? You said resources.
That's a good question, and let me get to the last citation I'm going to make. I have hope, see? And the hope is validated by the federal government, see? What I'm quoting from is a report to congressional requesters by the United States General Accounting Office. What they're reporting on is something that the federal government has been supporting for the last few years, a partnership arrangement between child welfare programs in schools of social work and the child welfare departments in states. It's a partnership between two that they're supporting with a lot of money to get people to train in schools of social work and support them with stipends and with their course of training. And they've been doing then a study on the effectiveness of the partnership. And let me quote from one of the evaluations. And this is once again from the United States General Accounting Office. And this is a 2003 report, right? I want to cite that because the citation indicates the fact that it comes from a source that has great respect. So if they say it, they've said something, you could, and they say, evaluations in Kentucky and California also suggest that training partnerships improved working competence. In both states, evaluations found that staff hired through the specially designed 4E child welfare program performed better on the job and applied training more deftly than employees hired through other means. They're saying that they're supporting this program, and in supporting this program, they're saying, we recognize the fact that social work profession has something to offer. And they're saying in our first evaluations of this partnership, which we underwrite, there are indications that a measure of success. So I go on faith, but my faith is validated by the United States Congress.
And that, I think, you know, as you of course know, in our school in Madison and many schools of social work, right, the Title IV-E yeah. training program has been quite a boost to,
yeah.
I think, the relationships between state, federal, and the schools and the workforce yeah. in general. And it certainly has grown a great deal. So that's some I'm happy to hear some optimism,
yeah.
some optimistic kinds of things. Let me ask, because you've talked a lot about child welfare, but I think you're saying analogous are the other fields that social workers deal in, also to the point of needing to demonstrate that interventions with other populations that social workers deal with are also something we need to continue to develop.
The charge that was made in declassification was most clearly made, as I know it, in terms of child welfare. I'm off base in answering that question with any confidence because my real area of concern was always child welfare, and while I was concerned with social work generally, I have more peripheral knowledge of what's going on there. So I would answer your question with less confidence okay. than I can answer it with reference to child welfare.
Now you get at a little of this, but what's your hope for the future of the profession, and you know, what do you see happening in the future?
Well, I see, as I said, that little by little we may deal with the problems in a more effective manner as we do more research and we do develop a more effective technology. This indicates the beginning of the validation of that faith. I still think that it's going to be a very slow endeavor, simply because the problems we face are very great. And the problems we'll continue to face. In the most idyllic society, if we repaired the world to its most effectiveness, there still will be people who need social work, professional service. There still be children who have lost their way, the children, the families who are disrupted, and so on and so forth, in the best of all possible world. So there's no end to the requirement for the work that social workers do. But developing that ultimate effectiveness, I see as a very slow endeavor because of the nature of the problems that we face.
Now let me ask you, because we've talked about child welfare, focused on that, and I want to focus on it still, about when you say a technology, when you say the kinds of interventions that social workers do, what levels of practice are you talking about? Because, you know, we have the relationship, the interview, the work with the family. Yeah. And we have, and as I think you've said, but we haven't said it exactly, is these are often embedded in all kinds of different systems and all kinds of different dilemmas. So when you think of child welfare practice, are you thinking of needing to demonstrate, at what levels are you thinking we, our job should be, or we can demonstrate success?
I go from where our job is now. It's true that social work practice and the problems that social workers, child welfare workers deal with are embedded in the society, and all of this is acting on the family. Currently, if you take a look at what social workers do, more than 70% of social workers are doing what is direct practice. Another 20% or 25% are doing what is called education and social work, administration and social work, or supervision and social work. 1% of social workers are dealing with repairing the world, are dealing with social action. 1%. Between social action and community organization, you got 2% of the social workers. The charge to social work and the charge to child welfare is not to repair the world. We don't know how to repair the world, and that's not our research is looking to achieve. We're in direct practice, which means direct association with the client, the family, in order to affect change in the family, in order to affect change in the interaction in the family, so that the child is less open to harm, the child is more adequately cared for. Currently, and let me emphasize over again, over 70% of the people who are in social work are engaged in direct practice. We do not, despite the conceit of the profession, we're not going to reorder society. We don't know how, we don't have the power, we don't have the skill, we don't have the numbers who are engaged in that.
But let me, I got to challenge you on some of this.
Yeah.
Because we've got, you're still painting a picture, you're painting a very micro level picture.
That's right.
Okay. But there, and then you're contrasting that to a very macro level change in the world thing. But there's a lot in between.
Yes.
So that social worker is working at Human Services and child abuse and neglect.
Yes.
Is not just working, I mean, they're working with that family and that child, but they're working with the systems that family and child is dealing with. So what, do they need skills, or do we have obligations for making that school system work better for that child, for making resources, or, you know,
it's a different
level of macro practice, if you will.
And in direct practice, people do that. In direct practice with the family, they're engaged in providing the resources that are available. But they only provide the resources that are available. When AFDC was the program that the social work, child welfare program was dealing with, when you came and I could provide you with AFDC payment, I used that, see. When we went to TANF, now we can't go to AFDC. We didn't invent TANF. We didn't do welfare reform. We had nothing to do with welfare reform. So we're given these resources, and we exploit these resources, not so much on a direct level, in order to help the family. That we do now, and that we'll do then. So the techniques of collaboration with people who provide other resources is part of the armamentarium of the social worker in direct practice.
Right. So I think that is important to stress that we're not talking about micro level and we're going to sit in a little office together and just talk.
A kind of psychoanalytic
or historic. No. We're talking about a range of skills. What I think your position seems to be, and I have said it very clearly, is it's not necessarily the professional goal to make large societal changes.
Yes.
A responsibility. Well, but how do you feel about social workers being involved in those? See, there's one thing I think to say about, that's not the job or technology exactly. On the other hand, is there not an obligation of a profession who talks about the importance of working with oppression, the importance of issues of discrimination, of poverty? Is it not part of that job?
No, it's part of the individual as a member of society, as a citizen of society. But you can't go out and reduce oppression. You can't go out and reduce discrimination. We don't have the professional technology or skills to do that.
Don't we have some obligation to try to develop that?
We have an obligation, but not as professionals. I'm making a distinction between the individual and the professional. When I was on the campus and made speeches against Vietnam, I didn't make speeches as a social worker performing professional social work activity. I did it as a citizen of the United States, as a citizen of Wisconsin. When we try to get people to sign a petition to recall McCarthy, I didn't do that as a social worker. I do that as a citizen. When we marched in the first gay pride parade, I and Sylvia, we didn't do that as a social worker. We did that as a citizen.
I'm going to keep challenging on this because you use the analogy of medicine, okay? Do doctors not have a responsibility to advocate for public health, for broad level societal interventions?
Yeah.
And if they have that responsibility, why don't we have the responsibility of looking at the causal factors, or at least the contributing factors to the kind of problems that social workers deal with, and some obligation to change those for them?
But the doctors have it as citizens. But they have professional organizations that are have much greater power than we do. They go to Congress with people who are hired to advocate for their position. They got a lot of money for that. We, as a social work profession, don't have any people buttoning whole congressmen on welfare reform. We don't have the resources for that. We don't have the numbers for that, and we don't have the reputation for that. See, when doctors speak, people listen. When social workers speak, people don't often listen.
But is that a reason? Maybe we're looking at a social work education. Is it not the role of social work educators and think to look at some of those broader issues? I think the dilemma I'm having is, okay, you've got that individual social worker working with a family who's got all kinds of issues and concerns, and you're saying bring the kinds of resources to bear that's going to help that family in various ways. But I'm still having problems thinking that it's not the profession's responsibility, however they get that done. It may not be to say that you as child welfare worker have to go out and, you know, change the world on your own, but is not that the profession's responsibility to call attention to the core kinds of issues?
Yes, it's a professional responsibility to call attention to all those kinds of issues. They call attention as a professional organization, but not in terms of their professional expertise. And that shows in the number of people. If you take a look at the people in schools of social work, what their specialization is, there are no people in community organizations. 2% of your student body is in community organizations. Nobody is in social activism.
But you know, doesn't that speak to the role, the education's role, to broaden? Not to say you have to now move into the role of social change advocate, and that's what your whole program going to be. But that, you know, people come into social work because they want to help people, right?
Yes.
The first thing we think about is the that person or that family,
that's
or that
right.
little group. But don't we have some obligation as educators to broaden our students' view to, again, the fundamental cause, some of the contributing causes? I don't think we're that far away in our
The student comes to me and says, listen, I came to school of social work because I want to help people on the macro level, you know. The big one is the macro.
Right, the big one.
On the macro. He says, teach me. He says, give me a textbook, you know, on the macro level. I go to my library, and I have an extensive library. I can't find anything. What do we have in our armamentarium, in our knapsack, that we were able to reach in and reach out and say, here, go do this. Right.
So what I think we're saying is that at the level of profession, we're still developing, need to develop the technology and what might be the core part of what people do.
That's right.
But before, you're suggesting, I think, but before we move into a much broader macro level thing, we either have to develop that technology or we have to acknowledge that we may not have that technology.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair, but let me add something else. See, a profession operates on the sanction of the community. That's why they support the profession. The sanction community says, we want this job done, and we're sanctioning you as a group. Nobody's going to sanction the social work profession to change the world. They sanction you to meet with the family on direct level. That's what they're sanctioning you for. But they're not going to sanction you to change the world. That's where I stand.
Before we maybe conclude, other thoughts or anything kind of you felt like you've left out over time or you would just like to share with us about the profession, about the future, about the past? I mean, that's a...
Well, I had a series of statements, Mel, that I didn't take with me. Mission statements, you know, mission statements of NASW, mission statements of CSWE. And the mission statements are so euphoric, not euphoric, that's not the word.
Grandiose.
So grandiose. That if I gave that mission statement to a person who was in the general community, I said, What profession do you think is represented by this mission statement? It said, we will reduce oppression, we will reduce discrimination, and etc. They're not going to reduce oppression, they're not going to reduce discrimination, but those are the mission statements. And the thoughts that I have is the mission statements are so illusionary, that's the word I was looking for before, that I tend to move in the opposite direction to an emphasizing direct practice in opposition to my strong feeling against these empty, open admission statements that are idyllic, but beyond the level of anything we can achieve. And I'm sorry I didn't bring those statements.
No. Many of us will have read those statements, and I think I understand.
Yeah, I know.
They're quite long, too.
Yeah, I know. That's my last thought.
Well, you know, I really want to thank you for, you know, sharing. Your life and about the profession, and
this is easy sharing. The Talmud says that you can share knowledge without being any less wealthy. See, so that sharing
it
is easy.
Doesn't cost anything to share knowledge?
Doesn't cost anything.
Oh, okay.
Unlike many other kinds of sharing,
right,
see.
Right.
So it was easy sharing.
Well, even though it doesn't cost anything, I think I certainly benefit, and I think people who will hear this will benefit. So
okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much.